This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, we're going to be talking about Pete's Dragon, Sausage Party, Florence Foster Jenkins, Eat That Question, Frank Zappa in his own words, and Microbe and Gasoline. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course, the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, you can find me at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
I'm going to start talking a little bit about the box office and success or possible lack thereof of Suicide Squad. And I'm talking about this not in the box office segment because that's looking ahead. I want to talk about the business behind Suicide Squad and what actually happened last week and where there are some misconceptions. Now, one of the things, and I was absolutely right about this, it didn't come in as low as I said. I said it was going to be closer to $100 million, but it still did not hit that magical $140 million that everybody was predicting and then was going up and up throughout Thursday night and Friday. Suicide Squad is not a bona fide hit. Do not let that opening weekend number of $133 million fool you. It has some problems, and it's going to have the exact same problems as Batman versus Superman. Now, this is coming, first of all, prefacing it. I'm somebody who loved Batman versus Superman. I actually enjoyed that movie. I enjoyed it. I thought it was a great kickoff. Not everybody did. But Suicide Squad was getting a lot of the same reactions. High anticipation, reviews come out, and in fact has a lower Rotten Tomato rating now than Batman versus Superman. And that makes a difference. Now, I've gone on record plenty of times and saying critics don't matter in terms of its box office. That's not 100% correct. There are plenty of movies that do well without critical support, and there are plenty of movies that have great critical support and don't do well. What critics can do is bring attention to a movie. And what critics can do is sometimes, especially when you come to something like these comic book movies, where a good chunk of the critics nowadays aren't just stuffy art house guys in tweed jackets smoking pipes at New York movie houses. They're people who grew up with comic books. So you're playing in their sandbox at this point, which is why the Marvel movies tend to have such good reviews, because it's tapping into these people's childhoods. Now, Suicide Squad, it's a great opening weekend number, and Warner Brothers is very impressed. But Suicide Squad is not a single movie alone. Suicide Squad is a part of a larger piece. And this puzzle, which has all these pieces that Warner Brothers wants to have put together, they want the critical acclaim. They want to do what Marvel has done. And it's so painfully obvious that's what they want to do since Avengers took off. But they're not getting the acclaim that the Marvel movies have. And I'm talking Marvel Studios movies. You can't throw the original Daredevil with Ben Affleck in there. The first thing that the opening weekend box office tells us, it was incredibly front-loaded. It did extremely well Thursday night. It did very well Friday. Then it started to drop. It had a 40% drop between Friday and Saturday, which is a larger drop than Batman versus Superman had. Comparatively, Captain America Civil War had less than a 20% drop. And then it dropped again on Sunday. The movie that this is actually best comparing to is Batman versus Superman, because they have almost identical cinema scores. They have almost identical Rotten Tomato scores. The difference is Suicide Squad's out in the summer. And you've seen that it's got a bit of a bump this week so far with its midweek box office. It's actually gone up, but that's to be expected because kids aren't in school. I mean, you compare it to Batman versus Superman or Deadpool or even Captain America, which was technically a summer movie, but it came out in the beginning of May. It's probably going to end up with a multiplier around 2. Now, the multiplier is basically the number you apply to the first weekend, and that's your final gross. That's what Batman versus Superman had. It had almost a 2. A good movie with legs has closer to 3 or more. For example, Captain America: Civil War had an opening weekend of almost 180 million, and it topped off with over 400 million. So it was over a 2 multiplier. That meant that it had good legs. And the reason it doesn't have good legs, it has a cinema score of a B+. Now, a lot of people say, oh, a B+, that's good. Take home a paper for your parents, and they'll be like, well, I'd rather have an A, but a B+ is good. Not when it comes to cinema score. Anything less than an A is a bad cinema score, and there's a reason for that. A cinema score is calculated by interviewing the people coming out of a movie. You can assume that the vast majority of the people in any movie are there because they want to see the movie. You have already taken out all the people who don't care about the movie because they're not at the movie. An A is a good rating, but anything lower than an A means you're getting some B's and C's and people saying it wasn't that good, and it depresses the score. And it's going to show that the word of mouth gets around. Now, a lot of people also compare this to Deadpool. It had an almost identical opening weekend. It made like $1.5 million more than Deadpool did. The difference is Deadpool had this alarmingly large multiplier, almost 3, and a great cinema score. In fact, of all the superhero movies that came out this summer, Batman vs. Superman, Captain America, X-Men Apocalypse, with the exception of that opening weekend, Deadpool beats almost every one of them on a day-to-day basis, especially Batman vs. Superman, once you get past like day 4 or 5. Now, like I said, the midweek for Suicide Squad's decent because there's kids out of school. It was February when Deadpool was out. Kids were all in school, and it was an R-rated movie on top of that. So you had adults going to this thing. The other difference between Deadpool and Suicide Squad, Deadpool cost a fraction of what Suicide Squad cost. And that is the important thing. Deadpool cost like $58 million to make. Suicide Squad's 3 times that, like $175 million. And on top of it, Warner Brothers is making a franchise. They want legacy. This is like a president. They don't want to just be remembered for being elected. They want the legacy. They want the library. All these mega franchises, stuff like Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings, both of which were spearheaded by Warner Brothers, and the Marvel movies and Star Wars, these all have positive ratings. If you do not have the positive ratings, you're going to lose your audience and it's going to sink very quickly. Look at what happened with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. It took one sequel to tank that. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Two real quick ones I want to talk about really quick. First one is Bad Santa 2, opens on November 23rd.
We got a job. I'm talking millions this time.
Why are you even out of the joint anyway? You know, they used to sterilize guys like you.
Early release, you racist moron.
Minecraft, Halo 5 Guardians, Assassin's Creed Chronicles Trilogy.
Yeah, that's great, that's great. Nah, I don't care.
You need a hug from Santa.
I wasn't a huge fan of the first one because I feel that it just kind of went for low-hanging fruit a lot of times. It wasn't as outrageous and funny as it could have been. It just, once you got the bad Santa jokes, once you're like, okay, he's a terrible person, it's not as funny because it just seems somewhat repetitive. But a lot of people loved it. This is one of those movies that when you make a sequel 10 or 15 years after the original, who knows if it's going to do well. You can cut a good trailer with a lot of swearing by Tony Cox, but that does not mean it's going to be good. Next one I want to hit really quickly is Max Rose, starring Jerry Lewis, opens in September for limited release and in October for wide release.
Something happened between you and Mom that you haven't told me or anyone?
Oh, her compact.
You're the secret in my heart, Ben.
I thought you gave it to her.
Max is a piano player.
Can you play the blues?
I live the blues.
You had your music, you had Mom. You guys somehow loved each other day in, day out for 65 years.
Talk about a guy who's had so much of a career. He's a fascinating person. If I remember watching Hardly Working when he was trying to get back in the game as a kid, I didn't quite get it because I never didn't grow up with Jerry Lewis. But you go back and watch the old Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis stuff, and it's great. And he really defined himself as a director. So, you know, this one looks like it's going for Oscar bait. It's going for legacy, as we talked about with movies. It's not just about the entertainment of the specific thing. It's about the legacy. I would not be surprised if this gets a bit of an awards push this year because Jerry Lewis, he's like 90. And this is his chance to kind of go out on top. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Microbe and Gasoline and Florence Foster Jenkins. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, coming back at you and getting ready to start the movie reviews. We're going to take a trip over the ocean and settle into France and talk about a movie that is by a French director who has had American hits before, but it looks like he's going back to his roots, and that's Michel Gondry. And this film is Microbe and Gasoline. Two French teenagers build their own go-kart disguised as a garden shed and plan a trip across the country over the summer. Now, I'm not going to play a trailer for it because it's French, and I've said before, I'm not going to be playing foreign language trailers because I don't know what they're saying. Now, the reason I'm covering this is because Michel Gondry has done movies in the United States before. His biggest movie was The Green Hornet, which wasn't a success, and it wasn't a big hit. But it was enjoyable to a certain degree. And he did movies like The Science of Sleep, and he did Be Kind Rewind, the one with Jack Black and Mos Def. They were sweeting their films. They were taping over movies in a video store. Talk about archaic. Be Kind Rewind, I don't even think the millennials remember, I mean, unless they're doing it in an ironic way, remember videotapes. You know, I mean, it's all downloads. It's not even, you don't even rent DVDs much anymore. But Gondry had a bit of a career in America, and that's, it's not uncommon to see this happen, where you have a director from another country, in this case France, have a success, and then try to emigrate to the United States to take advantage of the Hollywood system, and you end up with them bringing along their sensibilities and people not quite clicking with it. And that's what happened with Michel Gondry's stuff. I mean, stuff like The Science of Sleep, that one got an American release, but whew, that movie was out there. And Green Hornet was his most accessible movie, but even then it felt like a French artist trying to do a superhero movie, and it didn't quite work. And as evidenced by its January release date. The movie Be Kind Rewind does kind of turn very French after a certain time, and it just doesn't click with an American audience. And so he went back to France. And you saw this happen with people like Luc Besson, although he has a little more of that pop culture action film oriented style, so he can still spearhead movies like Taken and produce them and have them be hits in America. But Gondry, I think he had to go back to France. And so this is basically a coming of age story about these two kids. They get beaten up and bullied at school. You know, it's funny. It's an interesting companion piece to watch with Sing Street, which recently came out on DVD. And that's a fantastic movie. Sing Street takes place in Ireland about these kids that get bullied and then they make their own band and kind of become a hit in their little town. And that's a charming little film. This one has a lot of the same connective tissue. I mean, it's about these kids that are unlikely friends, and they've got problems with their families, and they've got to deal with their brothers, and then they kind of go do their own thing. In this one, it's more of a coming of age, of finding themselves, and it has some very funny moments to it. I mean, the whole thing is they build this go-kart, and they can't get a license for it because it's a go-kart. It's not a car, and they can't drive it on French roads, so they build a shed around it, and they hide in the shed, so whenever the police come by, they pull over, cover the wheels, and the police think it's just a garden shed. Why it's built on the road, who knows, but that's the way they work. Microbe and Gasoline is a charming little film for the coming of age crowd. And it's very French. It has that French angst dripping through it at times. But overall, it's a charming little movie. And it shows why Gondry got known before he moved to America and didn't quite get his career started. So I'm going to have to say Microbe and Gasoline kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Florence Foster Jenkins. Meryl Streep plays an aging socialite who loves music and gives many private concerts with the dream of playing Carnegie Hall, undeterred by the fact she's one of the worst singers in the world.
When I was 16 years old, my father told me that if I didn't give up music, he'd cut me off. Of course, he didn't understand. Music is my life.
Maestro, do you think I'm ready for a concert?
Expand your diaphragm, Florence.
I think Madame Florence might need more lessons.
Please.
My wife is ill.
Singing is her dream, and I'm going to give it to her.
We have to help her, because without loyalty, there's nothing.
This is essentially a story about William Hung in the 1940s, and it's based on a true story. Florence Foster Jenkins was a real woman, and she was truly not a good singer. But she had the money to kind of surround herself with yes men. She could pay somebody enough to pretend that they were coaching her. And she could play an accompanist who would not say, oh my God, you're terrible, while he's playing the piano. And she would give concerts, and they would be small events, but they would stack the audience with people that they knew would be kind. And she actually had a following back in the 40s. There were people who loved her spunk. They loved the fact that she was undeterred by her lack of talent, and it says something about the human spirit, about doing what you want to do in light of everyone telling you that you can't make it. What's interesting is Meryl Streep is known as one of the best actresses on the planet right now, and it's always been said that to act like you're acting poorly is the sign of a good actor. I mean, a good actor can act poorly on purpose. A bad actor just acts poorly. And there's a difference. And a good singer knows how to sing poorly. Now, Meryl Streep's never been a great singer. She's sung before. I think she sung in Postcards from the Edge. And of course, she sang in Mamma Mia. But even if you go back and you watch Mamma Mia, she kind of Carol Channinged her way through it. She's not a singer. When I go to my in-laws, and if I were to rifle through their record collection, I would find stuff from Barbra Streisand and the Carpenters and, you know, Neil Diamond or whatever. I'm not going to find any records of Meryl Streep recording. And I'm sure maybe she cut a couple albums way back in the day, but she's not known for her singing. And that's okay. She's a fantastic actor. But I think it was very brave of her to do this, because she basically has to be terrible in this movie. And it takes a good actress to be terrible. And she plays it in such a charming way because she is so aloof and loopy. And I'm not always a huge fan of Meryl Streep, but I mean, Ricky and the Flash last year, which she sang in, I did not like that movie. And again, she wasn't, you know, you're not going to cut albums with the material that she had in Ricky and the Flash, but she gives such charm to Florence Foster Jenkins. And that's really what makes it work, because she's so clueless. And I don't know how clueless the real Florence Foster Jenkins was, but it works. And the story behind this is she actually had syphilis, and she was in late stages of syphilis. She had gotten it from her husband, who was, he slept around. Now, back in the 40s, there was no treatment. You couldn't take antibiotics, because even if they were being developed, she had been in the later stages, and there's nothing you can do at that point. So she was suffering from syphilis. And had been for years. And her husband, they had an abstaining relationship. So he had a girlfriend on the side, and Rebecca Ferguson from last year's Mission Impossible movie, she plays his girlfriend, who's essentially his wife. I mean, he treats her as his girlfriend slash wife. But of course, all of this is all predicated, all these things, all these lies, and you're not a good singer, and oh, I'm having sex with another woman, are all predicated on the fact that you have to have this veil over Florence Foster Jenkins' face so she doesn't see this stuff happening. And as long as she doesn't know what's happening, she's okay with it. It's very charming, and it's sweet. It's the kind of movie you take your mom to. And it's getting a rather early release to be considered for awards, but I think it's just almost a little bit too whimsical and goofy to give a serious dramatic push, because it's a lighthearted film. And I think they dropped it into August so that they weren't competing with all the heavy stuff in October, November, and hoping people will remember this. And maybe the soundtrack. I think it would be great if her butchering of songs wins an award. So, Florence Foster Jenkins kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Pete's Dragon and Eat This Question, Frank Zappa in his own words. Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, continuing with the movie reviews. Let's talk about the family movie for the weekend, and that is Pete's Dragon. A young boy is stranded in the woods and befriends a mysterious dragon to stay safe until he's discovered 6 years later by a park ranger.
How long has he been out there?
6 years.
Nobody can survive in that forest for 6 years. At least not alone.
You'll see. I have Ellie. You need to get back to him. He gets scared when I'm gone.
Is Elliot a person?
No.
He looks like a dragon.
What's a dragon? That's a dragon.
I remember seeing the original Pete's Dragon when it was released in theaters back in the late 70s. What was it, like 1977 or something? And I was a little kid at the time. I was like 5 or 6, and I loved it. I absolutely loved the movie. It had the music and the songs, and it totally clicked. As a 70s movie, a Disney animation, it totally clicked. And years later, I watched it again, and it runs long. It's a bit of a slag to get through at times, because the original cut's like 2 hours. And there's been various cuts on video, and I think like the TV version went to like 90 minutes, and then when they released that in the clamshell VHS back in the 80s, that thing was probably about 90 minutes, but they put the full cut on DVD, and I've seen the full cut, and I've shown my kids DVD and Blu-ray that have came out a couple of years ago. I think when they knew they were going to remake it, they decided to get it out there. And it's a little bit hard to get through now. There's a lot of stuff that is very much geared towards little kids, but not so much today. It's not fast moving, the original, but it's still very charming. This one is extremely different. The original takes place in like 1910-ish in this coastal town of Maine-ish in Passamaquoddy. It's about this kid that's sold into slavery. There's a lot of, like, I guess you would say inappropriate content, because Pete is a kid who's been who these hillbilly family owns. Shelley Winters spearheads them. And so Pete is trying to get away, and Helen Reddy and Mickey Rooney take him in under their wing because they're father and daughter, and her husband is out at sea, and Elliot the dragon is all cell animated, like in a Don Bluth style. It's very weird looking dragon. It's goofy. But it's also very charming. It has some great songs in it, and has this showman, this snake oil salesman who comes to town and then wants to get the dragon and essentially butcher him, cut him up and use him for all of his products. This one has a lot less butchery planned. This one also has a lot less child slavery in it. There's no music, and this is not a musical. I mean, it has a song in there, but it's just a normal song, and it's woven into the movie. They don't have big show-stopping numbers. So it's extremely different, but it's at its core, it's the same thing. It's about a boy who befriends this dragon that everybody thinks is imaginary, or doesn't even know exists. But instead of that goofy Don Bluth cell animated dragon, it's much more realistic, and it's much more down to earth. But that's okay, because there's this Disney magic woven into it. Even the bad guys, that Carl Urban plays, the closest you're going to get to a bad guy in this movie, he is the brother of a guy who runs a logging company. And when he discovers there's a dragon, he of course wants to capture it and put it on display, and he wants to own it does he have a dragon license? Do you have the dragon tag for his license, for his hunting license? I don't know. As I'm watching this, it's because I know a little bit about hunting. I'd be like, well, you don't own the land, and you trespass to get the dragon, and the dragon would be owned by the national park. And so there's a lot of legal things that some nerd like me understands, but they gloss over that. He's the worst of the bad guys in it, but even then he's not terrible. He's not there wanting to butcher the dragon like the bad guy did in the original movie. There's nobody trying to enslave Pete like there was in the original movie. It's a very much a charming movie. And what's funny is it has this tone that reminded me a lot of Where the Wild Things Are, if you remember that movie about 5-6 years ago, which was Spike Jonze's adaptation of the Where the Wild Things Are book, which was a neat adaptation, but it was so steeped in angst and suicidal thoughts that it really wasn't a movie for kids. This is definitely a movie for kids. And it's charming and it's sweet and it's at times awe-inspiring. And what's nice about it is it shows, and I think this is important for some people to see, it shows characters in shades of gray. Like I said, there's no bad guy, there's no mustache twirling villain in here. Everyone just has their own agenda and it's different. And that's, I think, important. Now, there also is an underlying environmental message, but I don't think it's heavy-handed. Now, you have these loggers that are cutting down trees, and I know there's going to be people who are going to be like, oh, it's a logging, anti-logging message, PETA, blah, blah, blah. And it really isn't that, because they work at a lumber company, and they're harvesting the trees, and they're at odds with the park ranger who wants to keep as much forest as possible, but it's not even giving a who's right and who's wrong. The only reason that Elliot and Pete knock heads with these folks is because they're just encroaching on their actual territory. It's not saying you shouldn't cut down trees. It's not even giving a harsh message. So if you're hearing that, I would, you can settle on it. It's not an anti-logging message. It's just who's going in the woods at this point? You know, that's going to be people, you know, that deep into the woods. It's going to be park rangers and logging companies. So that's where the characters are. So it's a sweet movie. It's definitely worth checking out. Take the kids. They're going to love it. So I'm going to have to say Pete's Dragon totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Eat That Question, Frank Zappa in his own words. Eccentric and groundbreaking legend Frank Zappa's career is examined with archival footage and interviews about how he pushed the boundaries of music performance.
Zappa has often seemed to be a force of cultural darkness, bearded and gross and filthy, a lone, brutal reminder of music's potential for invoking chaos and destruction.
I'm famous, but most people don't even know what I do.
I hate to see anybody with a closed mind on any topic.
There is a deep, permanent, irreversible cynicism in you.
And I wish that I could have other people catch some of it.
I was a little young to really get into Frank Zappa, and it wasn't my sort of my style back when I was a teenager. He was still around. He's still making music in the 80s, obviously. But you can't have lived with any sort of awareness of pop culture through the 70s and 80s and even in the 90s without knowing who Frank Zappa was, and at least knowing he was an influence. And really what's funny is I remember, and they detail this in the movie, there was that huge push of putting the parent advisory lyrics, you know, that Tipper Gore was pushing. And what's funny is he, of course, is he's skewering the Republican administration during the 80s. Yeah, sure, he butted heads with some of them, but it was really Tipper Gore, who was, at the time, Senator Al Gore, Democrat, his wife. So he was getting hit from all sides by government. It was not a right or left thing when it came to Frank Zappa. He cheesed off everyone. This movie peels back the stuff that would be just immediately you know about Frank Zappa. It peels back the most popular songs, and it really digs in there, and it shows who he was as an artist. I'm not a big fan of musical biopics. A lot of them just are an excuse to pad it out with concert footage. But this reminds me almost like that movie Amy that came out last year about Amy Winehouse. It was a lot less about her music and about her train wreck of a personality, but it really got intimate with her. And this gets very intimate with Frank Zappa, and it shows that he was more than just somebody giving the finger to the world. There was a lot of art to him, and there was a lot of just really thinking outside of the box. And he was doing some weird stuff, and he was doing stuff that nobody cared about, at least in the general sense. And some of his music was misconstrued for good and bad. There's this whole scene in there, a whole discussion about one of his songs that's actually pretty crass, but it became a hit like in Norway because they didn't know the English language translation, and it sounded like a love ballad. So I don't think he was ever happy with everything that was going on, because I think he always wanted something more, and he think he was in conflict. You can see it in this movie, conflict with his own success, because to him and a lot of people, success is selling out, but he was also a victim of the record industry. So it's a fascinating look. It's so hard to encapsulate because it's not just about him writing songs and performing. It's about his more obscure stuff, and that's what I found fascinating. So, Eat That Question, Frank Zappa in his own words, kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, we're having a sausage party, and we're going to be doing the box office and the home cinema roundup. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, wrapping up the show this week into August, the doldrums of summer movie season. Ironically, this is a pretty good week for movies. I don't think I've trashed a movie yet, even Microbe and Gasoline, which was a French film, I've enjoyed. So this is an ironically odd up week, and I don't normally expect that for August. August is usually terrible. But wait till Labor Day. I'm sure it'll stink up a storm in Labor Day. Let's talk about one final movie of the week, and that is Sausage Party. Some food in the supermarket discovers the truth about what happens after they are brought home by humans, and a hot dog and various forms of bread try to warn the other items on the shelves.
Oh, yes, I'm the first to enter eternity.
Oh, potato, way to go, buddy!
The pipes are coming.
Oh, Jesus, me eyes! Oh, gummy skin! Just peeling me skin!
So, you have learned the terrible truth.
I gotta tell everyone.
Everything we believe is a lie.
First of all, I think it's worth mentioning, even though it shouldn't be a point to mention. This is not a movie for kids. If you can't tell by the marketing or the name of the movie, if you don't know what the name of the movie means, go look it up, because it is not a completely benign name of a movie. If you don't know by this and the people involved and the marketing that this isn't a kids movie, you deserve the crap storm you're going to get driving home trying to explain it to your children. Sausage Party, I respect in the sense that I don't think it's trying to pull the wool over anybody's eyes. I don't think that Seth Rogen and James Franco and Evan Goldberg and all these other people sat down and said, let's make a movie that looks like a kids movie, but it's not. It's pretty clear this is a grown-up cartoon, and people need to get past that, because it is not the first movie that is animated that is not for children. There's shows on TV that are not for children. Family Guy, American Dad, South Park, these are all animated. Just because they're cartoons does not mean they're for children. If you are having that mentality, you need to get kicked in the head, because that is not the way it works. And when it comes to movies, we've had grown-up cartoons since Fritz the Cat came out in the 70s. That certainly wasn't for kids. And, you know, you've got Japanese anime, stuff like Akira, which is definitely not for kids. At least the Japanese understand that you can have grown-up cartoons. Americans, people seem to see blindsided and gobsmacked whenever there's a cartoon. They go, this isn't for kids? It's like superhero movies. Just because it says a superhero movie does not mean it's for children. Don't take your kids to go see Deadpool. Don't show them Watchmen. You probably shouldn't be taking your young kids to see Suicide Squad. So let's grow up as consumers. Now, Sausage Party makes no bones about what it is. I mean, it literally opens up within 5 minutes. It is raunchy joke, sex joke, swearing, everything. It is very clear that this is not a kid's movie, and I respect them for that. They're not trying to pull the wool over anyone's eyes. Now, with that said, there are certain jokes that I think some of them just don't land, and you get that with any comedy. I mean, it's a 90-minute comedy. You're going to have several jokes that just don't work. But also, some of the jokes tend to be really going for low-hanging fruit. I'm not a prude, but just dropping the F-bomb isn't funny. I remember I once interviewed Jim Gaffigan, I mean, years ago. And one of the reasons I love Jim Gaffigan as a comedian is because he is extremely funny without being crass or gross. And that's okay. I like crass and gross. I love bathroom humor and sex jokes. But I remember asking Jim Gaffigan, I said, you'd never swear in your routine. Why is that? And he said, well, saying the F word isn't funny. Anybody can do that. making it funny without saying the F word. Now that's a challenge. And when you watch TV shows, like even like South Park, it's amazing to watch. Some of the episodes of South Park are so funny because of how they skirt around the jokes, because there are certain things they can't say on Comedy Central. Sometimes it's talking about Muhammad, but that's a whole nother story. There are times in this movie that they just throw in the F-bomb. Oh, look, a carrot's going to say the F-word. Well, that's not funny. It's got to be clever. So there's a lot of that. And once they get it out of their system, and then at a certain point, you're saying, okay, I get it. We know. We get it. They're sausages. We get it. She's a bun. We understand anatomically how this all works. Those jokes do get old pretty quickly. And they are then replaced with racist jokes. They've got a character called Firewater, who's basically a Native American. They've got a bagel played by Edward Norton, who talks like Woody Allen. You know, his little, oh, I want to ask what I'm doing now. You know, doing his little Woody Allen thing. They've got German mustard as Nazis. They go for the very easy jokes, but that's okay. You know, easy jokes are fine. And even though they don't always hit, they can be pretty funny. It's outrageous and ridiculous, and it has no redeeming value whatsoever, which is fine because it doesn't want to. The only real complaint I have about it, it has this weird, pushy atheism message. This creeps into movies at times. If you ever saw Paul, that's the one about the little alien where Seth Rogen played the little alien and had Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. There was this pervasive atheist message in that movie, and that annoys me, not because of what my own personal beliefs are. Ricky Gervais does this in Invention of Lying, if you've seen that movie. It's a very funny movie for about half, and then he doesn't know where to go with the premise, and it turns into this deconstruction of religion. And here's my problem with obnoxious atheists, and this is why there's a guy on the internet, his name's The Amazing Atheist or something like that. I don't like him because he's a jerk. He's an a-hole. He is not an endearing fellow. And I don't care what your beliefs are, and I've got my own beliefs, but don't be pushy and obnoxious about it. When I come out and rail against some of these faith-based movies that are so terrible, like God's Not Dead or God's Not Dead 2, I'm railing against them for the same reason why I have an issue with movies like Sausage Party or Paul or The Invention of Lying, where it just has this really pushy atheist message that you don't need in there. Because the whole thing is where they go after they leave the supermarket is like the great beyond. That's their heaven. And they talk about the gods and stuff. And it is showing this futility of reality. And they even they kind of really go heavy handed with the argument near the end of the film. And I'm just like, you don't need that in there. It's a stupid movie about talking sausages with a lot of sex jokes. So why should we take your atheism message serious? I don't care if you're an atheist, just don't be a jerk about it. Don't be pushy about it. It is respect other people and respect their beliefs, and we can all get along. Can't we all just get along? Still, Sausage Party is funny. It made me laugh. They gave me free drinks. I had 2 beers. So I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Was I correct? I'd already talked about being close to correct with Suicide Squad. I said around 100 million because I didn't know where it was going to go. Because, you know, it used to be back when Nikki Fink was running Deadline.com. She'd put updates up every, like, 2 hours. And they would go, oh, it's going to be doing 160 million. It's going to be doing, oh, wait, oh, no, no, oh, no. And then you see the projections dial back on Sunday for movies that were more front-loaded than they expect. And you didn't actually see that in real time like you used to, because Deadline only reports once on Saturday mornings and once on Sunday mornings. They've learned not to get egg on their face. But everyone was, oh, it's going to be 150 million. Well, it missed that by like 20 million almost. Suicide Squad still made quite a bit of money, but like I said, it's going to be very front-loaded, and I think this weekend it's going to sink like a stone. Now, back in March, when Batman versus Superman came out, and like I said, that is the closest you have in terms of comparison. Batman vs. Superman dropped in its second weekend almost 70%. I don't know if Suicide Squad's going to drop that drastically, but I wouldn't be surprised if you see a 60-65% drop. It's still probably going to win the weekend with 45 million, but that is a huge nosedive off of last weekend. Now, if it makes more than that, hey, maybe it's going to have more legs, and I could be wrong. But I'm not eating a hat. I told a friend I would eat my hat if it made 140 million or more, and it didn't, so suck it. probably what'll come up next is Pete's Dragon within the 20s, and Sausage Party's going to do well, but Sausage Party's going to draw a lot of the audience away from Suicide Squad. It's going to be very crowded all of a sudden, and that's why Suicide Squad's going to have some trouble in the next couple weeks. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Kind of a slow week this week. The big ones that are out are 11/22/63, which is the Stephen King story about the guy going back in time and then trying to meddle with his Kennedy assassination. There's also A Hologram for the King, which stars Tom Hanks. I've not heard good things, and this movie did not stay in theaters very long at all. Supergirl season 1 is out on DVD and Blu-ray. So if you want to catch up on that before the new season starts soon. And then Baskin, very grisly, about a group of cops who accidentally end up swerving into a village that also is a gateway to the underworld, we'll say. It's very grisly and gory, and it's sort of this dream logic movie, but it's very interesting. It's worth seeing if you're a horror fan. If you're not, stay away, because it'll make you sick. And that is it for this week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Kubo and the Two Strings, Ben-Hur, the remake, and War Dogs. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.